Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Once again, a few exchanges hit record highs and others are near their tops. Ross takes a look at gold, crude, the U.S. and Canadian dollars. He also wants you to guess which country has the hottest currency right now. President of InsideTrackTrading.com, Eric Haddock, examines the cycles involving the stock markets, the U.S. and Canadian dollars, Bitcoin, and the precious metals. Author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Bursts, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash, Hilliard Macbeth, joins us to discuss the latest in Canadian real estate and the impact of money laundering on BC's housing market. He also takes a look at gold, the stock markets, and the outlook for EVs. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always good to be back, Jim.
Ross, how would you describe the action on the stock markets this past week?
Well, we've come back from the first decent correction since the April bottom. A week ago, the S&P was up around 6,400, corrected down into about 6,250. Percentage-wise and point-wise, that was the biggest correction we've had since April. Same type of action over in the Dow and the NASDAQ. And we got a nice oversold signal, actually our first oversold springboard signal. So that's an oversold in a rising trend. And we got that in basically all of the major indices. And NASDAQ has recovered big time. It's back to all-time highs again as of this week. And, the nice thing about last week's correction is it gives us a new line in the sand to be looking at in terms of, where's the support and what do we have to be looking at. So I think sort of the 6250 level on the S&P and the low close of that week are probably the key items that want to be looking for as we move through August and into September.
What's going on with gold?
Gold is same type of signal, actually. Springboard signal on the corrective low, both in silver and gold, actually, and platinum and palladium. So the whole precious metals complex corrected well. Same type of buy signals there, and a good recovery. So, I was looking that gold and silver could recover maybe 38 to 50% of their declines. They've done better than that. Gold is back, and I think this is now the fifth test of that 34.50 level. Intraday we had the spike up in April. But if you look at it on a closing basis, that 34.50 is about the best that we've done. And it'll be interesting to see whether it can pop through right here. Looking at the dollar index, which has been one of the keys here, it rallied up 2 weeks ago to its 20-week moving average, so that should have been support. At the same time, that became a low for the precious metals. But the 20-week moving average, I should have said resistance for the dollar index. So it got up there, gave back about 60% now of that gain. And if it can push back up the 50-week moving average for the dollar index, that would be up around 101.5 to 102. That would become the next target. And, we'd want to see how the precious metals do on that move. On a relative basis, they've been performing well relative to the dollar index here for the last couple of months. So it might be that strength in the dollar is not going to drive the precious metals down too far. But, you know, we want to keep a pretty close look on them at this point. The strongest currency out there is the Mexican peso, corrected well, and it's back to new highs for the year. So, you know, rah-rah to the Mexicans here.
Is it still a relatively affordable place to holiday for Canadians?
Well, I think, you know, you grab a plane and just skip over the U.S., and it's a better place to be. I'm sure that, you know, from a currency perspective, it's not what it was a year ago. I mean, there were some really good bargains down there. But I would suspect with the influx of people from, well, all around the world who are deciding that maybe the U.S. isn't the best place to go, and where would our alternative be? And in this case, Mexico is at least high on my list.
What's happening with crude?
Biding its time, but with a downside bias here. And I would say that, you know, from our perspective, still stuck in a trading range. We've got the, we're sitting around $90 or $64 right now. The top of the bounce was at 70. You know, and if we look at the, earlier this year, it got stuck in a trading range between 55 and 64. So a couple of tests of 64 during that consolidation, the pop-up during the attack on Iran, and now that 64 level has become a support. So, you know, if it gives up ground right here, you're probably looking at something once again in the mid-50s. But for now, I don't see it as a trading vehicle. You know, hopefully we get some signals that will give us some guidance. But for now, it's for me, it's sit on the sidelines and just sit back.
What's the story for the Canadian dollar?
Canadian has been holding up reasonably well. And, you know, we're just sitting, giving up a little bit of ground relative to the U.S. into the early part of this week, but it's bounced back. And we'll be looking to see how it does relative to crude. That's always for us a key item to be looking at. And, you know, by the time we're talking next few weeks from here, we might have something more definitive for the Canadian. But for now, I think the initial break is behind us, and we were looking for a bounce, and we're probably going to see a bit more of that.
Anything interesting going on with Bitcoin?
Yes, we've had, just like every market, had a good sell-off. We've got nice support, I would say, at this point, time now, around 113,000. And we got good oversold signals. That was a retest of the highs that we saw in May, June, also back into what we saw at the end of the year in the first quarter of this year. So that sort of 110 to 113 level is pretty good support for now. Also, if you just look at a simple rising trend line, that's also going to come into play right here. I think the catalyst point to get it back to life, other than just a decent bounce that it's had so far, would be a close over 120, and then it's probably away to the races once again.
Ross, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Eric Haddock, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from Central California. Eric, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, well, thanks for having me back, Jim. Pleasure.
Again, Eric, can you maybe describe how InsideTrack works and how our listeners can subscribe?
Yeah, InsideTrack is a technical and cyclical advisory service focusing on the financial markets, although that's a branches out to a broad spectrum of markets. And listeners can get a lot more information, see a lot of archived reports, tutorials, analysis at our primary website, InsideTrackTrading.com. That's inside with two I's in the middle, so it's InsideE, TrackTrading.com.
The U.S. stock markets have been pulling back from all-time highs. Could the tops be in for these markets? And should we be concerned that October is only 2 months away?
Well, I'm not sure if you need to be concerned that October is 2 months away, but I do think that the stock markets, most of the indexes, have put in intermediate highs ever since we had the early April lows. There have been two or three primary things that I've been looking for that I keep publishing week in and week out. One was that the way the lows were formed in early April showed very quickly that the stronger indexes, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ 100, and also the Dow Industrials, needed to rally back to their highs and set new all-time highs in order to fulfill some monthly technical indicators that were triggered right at the lows in early April. So that has been one of the primary gauges I've been using to determine how close we might be to an intermediate top, and in this case, when we have fulfilled everything that's necessary for that, and for all intents and purposes, the equity indexes did fulfill that in July with cycles, a very consistent 8-month cycle that I've talked about coming into play in late July. That was actually exactly 8 months from the late November peak that the lead indexes set back in 2024. Before the 20-30% sell-offs we saw over a 3-6 month period there. So we came right into those cycles, those cycle highs, at the same time that those indexes were fulfilling their upside price targets. So you had the makings for a fairly significant top, but now I just need to see some key confirmation signals trigger to elevate this correction to more than just a 2-3 week correction and more something on the lines of a 1-2 month decline. And really one of the key things would be to see any and each and all of those indexes give daily closes below their August 1st lows. That would be a very decisive intermediate signal that that we've elevated this action and that the indexes are headed for lower levels in the coming weeks.
Interest rates have been pulling back. Bank of England, for example, just dropping its trend-setting rate to 4%. Do you think President Trump will get his rate cuts?
Well, I know that the global interest rates haven't had much impact on that. That's been one of his sticking points that he keeps citing as his desire for lower interest rates. But I do think that the charts are showing that bonds and notes have bottomed and that they should start to climb slowly but steadily, which would reflect a lessening or lowering of corresponding interest rates. So I do think that we have past that turning point and that we are going to see rates move at least a little bit lower in the coming weeks, coming months. I've even started talking about in my monthly Inside Track newsletter some more significant cycles that come into play next year and what implication they could have on interest rates. But for now, I think that we are in that phase of rates starting to edge lower.
Could the U.S. dollar have put in a head and shoulders bottom?
I'm not sure about the head and shoulders pattern. I guess you'd have to kind of stretch the definition of that for it to be perceived as that. But I do think that the dollar has or did put in a 1 to 2 month bottom back in early July. I think that it still has the potential for another 1 to 2 week rally in it, but my overall outlook remains the same, and that since late last year, that outlook has been that the dollar would top in January and then see a year-long decline into ideally November, December, when a multi-month bottom becomes more likely. So within that context, I think that the dollar has set a 1 to 2 month low. In fact, it came right at the midpoint of that overall down cycle, which is when it was looked for. And so we could see something where you see another dollar rebound into the middle part of August, maybe stretching a little bit past mid-month, but if it has made it back up to 101.50 to 102 on the dollar index, that would be a time and a place to start looking for signs of a rebound peak.
The Canadian dollar's been pulling back. Where is the Canuck buck in its cycle?
Well, I'm more focused on some of the technical indicators as opposed to just flat-out cycles. And I think that the Canadian dollar has been in a corrective mode, and its wave structure and several key indicators I watch have told me that it should retrace back to about 72 before we get the first signs or first potential for a secondary low. So I think there still is some more downside in the Canadian dollar before you have a higher likelihood for a two-wave or B-wave bottom.
Bitcoin peaked July 13th. Where is Bitcoin in its cycle?
Bitcoin just came through a very significant, very decisive cycle in July 2025, and that is where it had the best chance to set an intermediate peak, one that holds for at least a month or two. But I've been talking about this July 2025 cycle for over a year, and one of the indicators that really pinpointed that, there have actually been several cycle progressions that all lined up pointing to July 2025. But probably the most consistent has been a 16-month cycle progression in Bitcoin. And if you go back to late 2018 and follow Bitcoin forward from there, you'll see that it has followed this 16-month cycle very closely, first setting a bottom in late 2018, November, December, then 16 months later, setting another low in March of 2020. 16 months after that, it set a subsequent low in June, July of 2021, and then a fourth successive low 16 months after that in November of 2022. And as I explain in my cycle progression indicator, that once you have had four successive lows in a particular cycle, there's a much higher likelihood that that cycle is preparing to invert, preparing to cross over an equilibrium point, a zero value on a sine wave that I illustrated with. And so from that November 2022 low, Bitcoin projected a 15 to 16 month rally from there, which is what you saw unfold as it moved higher and set a intermediate high in March of 2024. And it was at that point and in the months since then when I started focusing on July 2025, what would be 16 months after that March 2024 peak, when I thought a more significant peak in Bitcoin would take hold. So that's what we've just come through. But at the same time, Bitcoin has shown a proclivity on an overlapping cycle to peak at six-month increments. That's kind of a geometric 180 degrees on a yearly basis cycle, where it saw peaks in January of 2024, then July of 2024, then January of 2025, all three projecting a future high for July of 2025. And at the same time, there was a intervening 11-month cycle that was spanning successive lows in Bitcoin. And that one, an overlapping 11-month cycle, was also indicating to look for a rally into July of 2025. So all these things, and these are things that have been detailed and illustrated for over a year, were focused on July 2025 as a significant cyclic time for Bitcoin and a high likelihood for a pretty significant peak. So that's where we're at in the cycle. As for the technical indicators, which are what I really need to corroborate those cycles and validate them, they have started to indicate a top, but there are two key signals I need to see in the coming days or weeks to convince me that a multi-week and perhaps multi-month peak is in place.
Gold's been in a trading range since April of this year. What are you seeing in the gold cycle?
Gold has really not deviated much from what have been uncannily consistent cycles. And many of them are linked to a 13 to 14 week cycle, a related 27 or the 28-week cycle, and an overarching 54 to 59-week cycle. And leading into April, really since October of last year, and then since early this year, all I kept focusing on was that gold should put in a very significant peak in late April, early May of 2025. But that would also be a precursor and a validator of a future cycle peak that I expect in late October, early November. In between those cycles, gold has consolidated. It has not yet turned any significant trends negative, but there are some critical weekly indicators that the August 8th weekly close is really going to be telling as far as what to expect in gold in the coming weeks and perhaps even the coming months.
Silver hit a new high in July, then pulled back. What are you seeing in the silver cycle?
Silver has been the real leader since from early April into late July, and that went along with all of the reports I put out earlier this year and then again in April and May, where I thought we were going to see a major surge in white metals, silver, platinum, and palladium, emanating from their early April cycle lows. And I detailed this in late March in my April Insight Track newsletter, how there was a combination of indicators that were poised to turn bullish on April 7th to the 11th, and that in my work was showing that we should begin an accelerated move up in all of those metals. And as that was unfolding, there were price targets taking hold, two key price targets that have been discussed for the past several months. One was for silver to reach $3,950 or higher, and the other was for platinum to spike up to $1,500. It was at a little below $900 back in April. And both of those objectives were met in July, just as silver was passing through the week with the greatest synergy of cycles. That was the week of July 21st to the 25th. And that's when I thought we would see silver put in a multi-month peak, as long as it was able to spike above $3,950 by then. And silver fulfilled that. Platinum spiked above $1,500 just at that time. And so all of those white metals fulfilled their 2 to 3 month and 3 to 6 month upside objectives in late July, and signaled that they were heading into a corrective phase. Within that corrective phase, I do have some very specific downside targets and cycle lows for silver that could be seen within the next few weeks. And at that point, as long as silver holds those levels and those time frames, I think that it would be ready for another wave up. But my overall outlook since, since early April, was that those white metals would see an overall bull market from April 2024 into April 2025 into April or May of 2026. So that's kind of the broader overarching outlook for those metals.
We're heading towards September. Is the gold stock cycle predicting a good September?
That I couldn't tell you. I don't follow a gold stock cycle indicator, so I really don't know for that. I said all along that I thought the XAU index would see successive highs in early to mid-June, early to mid-August, and then again in late October. So that's kind of my outlook where that's concerned.
Crude's had some volatility over the last few months. Where is crude oil in its cycle?
Crude oil remains in a real wide trading range, and again, it's not as much cycles as it is technical indicators. They're showing me that crude has been showing some signs of basing, and if it adheres to a couple of specific patterns over the coming weeks, really leading into mid-August, that it could be ready for a bit stronger rally. Same thing with natural gas. And so I'm watching it closely. There certainly have been some signs of bottoming on a longer-term basis, but it still needs to do more to really confirm that potential.
Natural gas topped in March. Are natural gas cycles seasonal?
They are seasonal in some respects, but the challenge there is that seasonal alternates from year to year and time to time, where we've seen some years where it's the excessive heat that has driven natural gas to spike highs in the third quarter of the year. And other years where it's been excessive cold that have triggered some moves in the first quarter. So from a seasonal basis, I think it's a little too ambivalent to really rely on that. Again, as with all my cycle analysis, it's the technicals that really need to corroborate and filter that. And the one thing that I had been watching in natural gas was a very consistent 35 to 38 week cycle that was projecting a pretty significant low to take hold in late July, early August. So we're just coming through that, and now there are several specific technical signals I need to see generated in order to validate that a low is taking hold.
The lithium ETF LIT bottomed in April and has been trending higher since then. Are you getting any readings on lithium and the lithium and battery stocks ETF?
Well, I know this has come up several times in the past, and I would just reiterate, first, they're two entirely different entities. By that, I mean lithium versus the lithium and batteries ETF. The ETF trades very much like a stock, as so many related shares do. And so that LIT ETF has traded consistently between 35 on the low side, 47 on the high side. Again, I think I detailed a lot of that last time we were talking. And it has been in a recovery mode along with stocks since early April. And with stocks passing through a potential peak here in late July, that is certainly one yellow flag for an ETF like that. But they don't all top at the same time as the overall market cycles. I often compare it to an old wooden roller coaster where you have multiple cars in that train that makes up the roller coaster, each car passing the summit at a different time, and it's not until the last car passes the summit that you're prepared for a more sustained down move. And so you see that even when you're comparing different sectors to the overall market cycles, that the final peaks are scattered around those cycle highs. But I think that lithium itself continues to be in the doldrums near multi-year lows, hasn't shown much signs of hope. There's been more and more oversupply, so it's waiting for some sort of change in the technical outlook where lithium is concerned before that would indicate any significant bottom or reversal up.
Eric, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money. And again, where can our listeners subscribe to Inside Track with Two Eyes?
Well, thanks for having me back, Jim. And your listeners can go to www.insidetracktrading.com. That is inside with the two I's in the middle, so it's INSIIDE tracktrading.com.
Thanks again, Eric. My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and President of InsideTrackTrading.com. Coming up, Hilliard Macbeth, next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. His website, MacbethMcLeodPartners.com. You can find him on X at HMacBE. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
It's great to be back on your show.
Is your book, now a good idea for somebody to buy, considering what kind of real estate market we're in right now? And where can people get it?
Yeah, so the book is, it is now 7 years old, and the market has been dropping since 2022. But the things that we talk about in the book, that I talked about in the book, are happening big time now. So now is a great time to look into the book and find out why prices are dropping, why there's a huge surplus of listings on the market. And you can find the book anywhere at any bookstore, or a lot of people buy it as an ebook through Kobo or Kindle, things like that.
Now, according to your book, when sellers want their price but buyers won't pay their price, what happens to the prices of homes?
So the problem with the sellers is one psychologist called an anchor price in mind, and that's why negotiators that are really good at negotiating always start with a wild number, and then you say, well, that rug is worth $10,000. Well, it's really only worth $1,000. So then a few minutes later, when it's down to $2,000, the guy thinks, gee, I got a huge bargain. Anyway, so in housing, the problem is that the house on the street that sold 3 years ago or 4 years ago for $1 million is not worth $1 million anymore, but that was the price they got. And so now if I'm selling my house, I think, oh, I got to get my house is better than that house, better lot, better location, better renovations. I should get at least $1 million for that house. But the reality is the market is now down to $750,000. But the seller's not willing to budge. But the buyers are hearing about prices being down 25%, and the buyers want to pay $750 or less even. And so it's a standoff. So what you get is what we've been seeing for at least a year or two now, which is very few transactions, which must be really hard on the realtors. But that's going to continue for a while until the sellers are finally forced to either give up on selling and keep their houses, or forced to face reality.
What's the latest on Canadian home sales, inventory, and pricing, especially in the greater Toronto area and Metro Vancouver?
So in Toronto especially, I got the data recently here now. The peak was in February of 2022, and prices are now on average about $300,000 below the peak. So 1.3 million down to less, just under 1 million for the average home. And of course, the problem with those averages is the mix matters. Like if it's condos versus single family homes, of course, single family homes are much more. But the Toronto Real Estate Board produces a benchmark, which is supposed to adjust for that. I'm not sure if it does, but it's a 25% drop. It's pretty significant. And there's still record numbers of listings of homes on the market. Thousands and thousands of homes in the greater Toronto area are listed above $1 million, $1 million or above. And they're not selling. And I don't know how the market can absorb that many. Vancouver is a little different. Prices have not come down as much. They are down, but they haven't come down as much. But the similarity is there's a huge number of listings in Vancouver and not very many sales. And interestingly, the number of places for rent has skyrocketed as well. So people have an option if they can rent. One of the reasons that people feel forced to buy a home is there's nothing to rent, or they can't find a nice place to rent. Well, that's no longer an issue in some of these major centers. There's lots of rentals. That's been the biggest thing that builders have been building is multifamily rentals. So there are options now available for more reasonable prices there. So again, that's not helping with finding buyers for those homes, but the prices really have to come down. Interestingly, we haven't talked that much about Edmonton and Calgary and places like that. Edmonton and Calgary have been known to have a firmer market, much firmer than the big centers of Toronto and Vancouver. But recently, there was a big surge in listings in Edmonton. I'm not sure about Calgary, but in Edmonton. And about twice as many listings as there were sales. So I think it's, numbers are much smaller, obviously. But 4,000 new listings and only 2,000 new sales. I'm rounding off. But so maybe that phenomenon is starting to hit Edmonton too.
We've heard money laundering is everywhere in BC. We've also heard if there's an end to money laundering, the real estate market will collapse. Your thoughts on that?
Well, money laundering, I went to a conference. I was a minor speaker at a conference, but David Eby, the now premier of BC, was the major speaker. And the whole thing was all about real estate in BC. And And this is a few years ago, and they talked about money laundering. They showed a video of a guy bringing a hockey duffel bag in with full of cash, right, into the casino, and then it gets laundered, and then it gets put into the Vancouver market. Well, it's ridiculous, you know. I mean, that's the amount of money that was coming into the greater Vancouver area was in the billions of dollars a year. Not that can't fit into. There aren't enough hockey bags in the world to fit that many dollars. So it was coming in through money transfers and that sort of thing. But if it ends, it'll have a huge impact, because that was the one thing that was, you know, making people in their mind, they need to justify the prices that they kind of know in their gut that they're paying way too much. But a money launderer doesn't care. So a money launderer will pay $2 or $3 million for that home. They just want to get the money placed. And the first step in money laundering is placement. And they don't really care if they pay $2 million or $1.5 million or $1 million. They just want to get the money placed. So that distorts the whole market. But if the market starts falling, as it has now, the money launderers will probably look for a different place to go. And the U.S. is probably was tougher on money laundering before, but now maybe it's more easygoing. I don't know. But the money launderers tend to move on, and then the real, we find out what the real market is without the money laundering, and it for sure would be lower, not higher.
Do you think a lot of mortgages are soon going to be higher than the price of the homes could be sold for?
Well, for sure in Toronto, all of the homes that were bought with a 75% or higher mortgage are now underwater because prices have come down about that much. So since 2022, people that bought years before that, of course, we probably still have some equity. But the problem with that is a lot of those people that bought years and years ago that should have maybe $500,000 in equity because prices have gone up that much have either refinanced on the mortgage to go traveling or to buy cars or to do renovations or to give their kids money to buy homes. So there's a lot of houses that are way more heavily mortgaged than they should be based on the increase in the prices because people have taken out more financing. I mean, that very famous slogan, "You're richer than you think," by the Bank of Nova Scotia, was entirely aimed at tapping that equity you have in your home. Why let that equity sit there? You can use it by borrowing against it with a home equity line of credit and do all the things, fulfill all your dreams, you know. And so that means that the some of the homes that are be underwater on the mortgage are homes that originally had a lot of equity, but now they don't have much anymore. And sometimes people do refinancing to pay off their credit cards as well, but then now all the debt's on the home. One signal that there's more and more of that happening is we're seeing from the bankruptcy insolvency trustees, they are starting to notice from what they posted on X that people are coming in with that are homeowners. That for years, no homeowners came in to see them because the homeowners could always refinance because the price of the home went up. They didn't need to go to the bankruptcy trustee, but now they're starting to show up in droves at the bankruptcy trustee. So there's no more equity left in a lot of those. Now that's, of course, the people that are in pretty serious trouble, but you know, people would be surprised at some very affluent looking reasonable households can get into trouble quite quickly if they don't adjust their lifestyle. If their lifestyle is dependent on that rising equity in their home and they don't realize that the equity is not rising anymore because the house price isn't rising anymore, they can get into trouble quite quickly.
On July 30th, the Bank of Canada left the bank rate unchanged at 2.75%. Are mortgages becoming tougher to get?
Well, you know, the bank rate doesn't determine the mortgage rate. The mortgage rate is based more on the five-year GIC rate, but that hasn't really come down much at all. The mortgages would be getting tougher to get, more not so much because of the price of the mortgage, but more because of the bank's willingness to approve the mortgage. And if we go into a recession, which looks very much like we might be, the employment numbers came out, and we're talking on Friday here, and they were quite bad. Some parts of, I think Toronto was up above 9%, or was it Ontario? But those are really high numbers of unemployment. So once that happens, the banks start getting, the banks being the biggest lender, of course, they do about 80% of the mortgages in the country.
they'll start to get pickier, more difficult to work with, and that's what happens. So mortgages do get more difficult to get approved, and also there's been a crackdown, I think, in the last few years on mortgage fraud, where people would hire mortgage brokers, and the mortgage broker would coach them on how to fill out the application form, maybe exaggerate a few things and that, and I don't know if that's as easy as to do as it used to be as well. Of course, the majority of mortgage brokers wouldn't do that, I want to be clear, but there were always a few that you could find that could help you in that way, so help you get deeper into debt. So the cycle has definitely turned. We're now 3 years into this, 3.5 years, I guess, from the peak in February 2022, and all of these things are only going to get tougher as the debt problems increase, and that'll force people to sell their homes, and that'll get the prices to come down more.
Are insolvencies rising in Canada?
Yeah, we talked about it a minute ago, and the increase, it isn't a huge increase. I checked just recently, and the total insolvencies have gone up about doubled from 2020 to 2020. 5 years, they've doubled, but they're still not at an extremely high level. 2020 was an extremely low time for insolvencies because the government flooded all that money into the system. And so people that would have probably gone insolvent didn't have to because of all the new money. But that money has long since run out. Like the people don't have that money anymore. And so now insolvencies are rising. So, and as I mentioned, we're starting to see homeowners going insolvent. Now, there's two types of insolvency. There's a bankruptcy proposal, a consumer proposal, which doesn't include the home. And then there's bankruptcy, which does include the home in the bankruptcy. So one of the things that is interesting is that the bankruptcies, the full bankruptcy, which includes the home, is increasing at triple the rate that the consumer proposals are. So consumer proposals were kind of an intermediate step. It wasn't as severe. It wasn't as there's not a blacklist on your credit score for very long. But more and more of those are going to straight to bankruptcy. That's much more serious event for a person. It might be a good thing to not have access to credit for like 7 years or something like that. Might save people from themselves, but it's still a pretty traumatic thing to go through.
What do you see ahead for the U.S. stock markets?
Well, the U.S. stock market is at record highs. It just closed to Friday at just a fraction of 1% off of a record high, but it's gone up an awful lot. Now, only about 10 stocks of the S&P 500 are providing almost all of the increase in the value. So when they do the S&P 500, it's huge, huge thing. The U.S. stock market is the biggest stock market in the world. The S&P 500 is the biggest index. And the biggest companies, the Magnificent Seven and the top 10 companies, are a big percentage of the higher percentage than they've ever been, higher than they were in 1929 or in 1999, the last two big peaks that we had. So we see that as a danger sign, and I would be very concerned about the valuation. The valuations are as high as they've ever been, and the concentration in just a few names is as big as it's ever been as well. So those are really loud alarm bells ringing over the stock market. Earnings for the other 490 stocks in the S&P 500, other than those 10, have basically been flat since 2022. So, and then you've got tariffs and things like that are likely to cause some problems for some of the companies.
The TSX Composite Index has hit new all-time highs this week. Are we likely to continue to see new highs there?
Well, the problem with the TSX is, and I wrote about that in my book, is that it's basically there's like two or three things that are really important. The banks, the financial services companies make up a big percentage of it. The six big banks are huge companies, and they have a prominent place in the TSX. And then the oil and gas companies are also very big as well. So the banks are going to have a headwind in terms of this 25% decline in Toronto housing. I mean, the Toronto housing market's the biggest market in Canada, and banks are 80% of the total volume in lending. And when prices are down that much, you can't lend as much money. Even if you get the same number of transactions, you're going to have 25% less loan because of the drop in value. So that the banks are going to be stagnant at best, and probably worse than that if people start defaulting on their mortgages. And then oil and gas, well, you know, it's a long-term trend, and most people don't agree with me on this one, but about 60% of all of the oil that's consumed in the world goes to transport. And in most countries in the world outside of Canada and the U.S., transport is very rapidly going to electric vehicles away from gasoline and diesel. And so that could mean, or will mean, that about 60 million barrels out of the 100 million are for transport, and eventually a significant part of that 60 million, maybe 30 million, half of it roughly, will be erased through electricity. That's a 30% decline in the demand for oil. So that's a trend that is going to have caused difficulties for the Canadian oil and gas market.
The TSX Venture Exchange peaked in July. What are your thoughts on the junior stocks?
Well, hey, we know, we talked about this before. It's kind of exciting, this gold and copper mining. Copper, of course, isn't really cooperating right now, but there's a lot of copper that goes into the electrification of everything. Even if people don't believe in electric cars, they probably believe in data centers. Data centers require a lot of electricity, and electricity requires a lot of copper. So, but the gold is what probably pushed the TSX Venture to a peak in July. And the gold price has been kind of sideways for the last couple of months, about $3,400 an ounce. But I think the strength in gold will resume. I saw that Argentina, for example, just got another bailout. It was announced in April, but it didn't get approved until just recently because the IMF had to do their review. So Argentina now gets another $20 billion, and they're a third of all the money that IMF lends, and it received very little attention. But what I'm getting at is fiat money is going to be difficult if countries like Argentina get into further difficulty. People are going to be more wary of putting their money into fiat money. Even the U.S. dollar is getting some uncertainty surrounding it, and because of the wild actions of the president and his tariff regime. So people are going to be attracted more and more to real assets, solid assets like gold and other things like that.
Yeah, gold continues to trade sideways, and there is talk of a new gold standard. What are your thoughts on gold?
Well, so everybody, you know, when you first think about the gold standard, say you see at a gold-backed currency, I think there was some country like Ecuador or something that, or was that crypto?
Anyway, that was crypto.
Yeah, it was crypto. Sorry. But some country somewhere will say, okay, our currency is backed by gold. Well, and the U.S. is the biggest holder of gold in the world, so they do have a lot of gold to back their currency. They don't have enough to entirely back it, but when you think about it, if they did go back to that regime where you actually could turn your paper money back into the central bank and get the gold equivalent, then it wouldn't necessarily be positive for gold, because now you don't have to hold gold anymore. You can just hold paper. It's a lot easier to hold paper than it is to deposits, you know, digital deposits backed by gold. So I don't know. I don't think they'll go back to gold because there's so much, so many bad things happened under the gold standard. There were so many depressions and stuff, and they don't like to be that constrained by the problem. When gold backs the currencies, then the economy can only expand as fast as the amount of gold in the system, and gold mining is very difficult. They're very hard to find new gold mines. There hasn't been a really big major new gold mine discovery for many years, so it would be a difficult situation to keep the economy growing, you know, really fast if every currency has to be backed by gold. So I don't think it's going to happen. But investor interest in gold, yes, I do think that's happening, it's going to continue.
Ex-Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said to the people, you will own nothing and be happy. Does it look like he could be right on half of that?
You know, I don't know if that's true. I don't know where. But if you own nothing, you will be happy. Yeah. I don't know. It's, you know, there's certainly the U.S., the difficulty with the U.S. and the the treatment that the U.S. is giving Canada is going to make things very difficult for Canada. I mean, like, we have this real estate problem that I wrote a book about, two books about. But on top of that, we now have a new problem, which did not exist before, which is our best customer, the United States of America, doesn't like us anymore. So the difficulty for Canada is the difficulties are getting greater, and we don't have the guaranteed market to export automobiles from Ontario anymore. We don't have the guaranteed market even, we might not even, so far we've got an exemption for oil and gas from Alberta and Saskatchewan going to the U.S., but who knows how much longer. The U.S. is a huge producer of oil and gas, and they might decide they don't want to import ours anymore. They could probably do it. They're also a big exporter of oil and gas, so they could just stop their exports and stop their imports. So, whether Justin Trudeau said that or not, I don't know, but certainly people Canada's going to go through a tough patch here. We've been a lucky country for many, many years. We lived off our resources that are commodities, and we had a great customer right next door that was always willing to buy. So times have changed. As the new Prime Minister Mark Carney said, the relationship is dead, and it's over, and now we have to find a new relationship. But it is a very important relationship. And, there's been talk about joining the European Union. It's not going to be able to, you wouldn't be able to replace what we had with the United States with joining the European Union. It's not the same at all. So we're going to have to find a new path in Canada. It's going to be hard on some people. There'll be some opportunities, too. It's just a little bit hard to see what they are right now.
Yeah. Now, according to Wikipedia, the phrase, "you'll own nothing and be happy," was actually published by the World Economic Forum.
So. Yeah, that would surprise me. They try to associate people like Justin Trudeau with the World Economic Forum, and what was his name, Klaus something, and then
Klaus Schwab.
And the other one is George Soros. They keep trying to associate people with George Soros, but the world is changing very rapidly, and all of those things are rapidly transforming, or they may disappear altogether. I was shocked to find out this week that a third of all the money that has been lent out by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has been lent to one country, Argentina. So, I mean, that's where Milei, the anarcho-capitalist, lives. He's the president. And he's the guy that you saw the picture of him with a chainsaw. He was going to cut government spending with a chainsaw. And then Elon Musk and Donald Trump were photographed with him. And so it's a very big change in the world. Maybe there'll be some good things come out of it, but certainly that old order, it won't exist anymore.
Do you think Prime Minister Mark Carney was brought in as an economic hitman to destroy Canada?
I don't think so, no. By the way, Mark Carney's written a book called Values, and it's very long. I think it must be 500 pages long. I'm about 200 pages into it. As he was the governor of Bank of England, governor of Bank of Canada, 11 or 12 years, head of a division of Goldman Sachs. Then he worked briefly with Brookfield. He's got a huge record of being in a bunch of different important positions. And so the book is interesting from that point of view. However, it's not going to be enough to solve the problems, whether he's a hitman or whether he's going to preside over some very difficult times. Who would have brought him in, right? I mean, he was just somebody who happened to show up at the right time and got lucky and ended up as prime minister, or maybe unlucky. I don't know which. But I think from watching him for a while, maybe I'm biased because he grew up in Edmonton. That's where I live. I think he's trying to do the right thing. But whether he'll be able to succeed is definitely up in the air right now. The headwinds Canada's facing are very strong.
So far, President Trump has ended 5 wars. He's likely to meet with President Putin soon. President Trump says so far he has commitments to invest $17 trillion in the U.S., The price of gas and eggs are coming down on the U.S. The southern border is tightening up. Canadian investigative journalist Sam Cooper says significant amounts of fentanyl actually being manufactured in Canada and sent across the border into the U.S. President Trump slapped Canada with a 35% tariff on August 1st, an incentive for Canada to put an end to fentanyl's industry. The U.S. is seeing success. If you were prime minister, what would you do to ensure Canada doesn't get left behind?
There's a lot in that question. Holy cow.
Yeah.
I think the issue is, what do, like, I've had conversations with several people in the last week about I think what the question is getting to, which is this elbows up confrontational approach that Carney is using with Trump. Is it working? It doesn't appear to be working, because on August the 1st, Canada got slapped with an additional 35% tariff, right? And now it isn't as bad as it looks on the surface, because the USMCA agreement, the trade agreement, is still in place, and it's a bit of a, I mean, Trump just loves headlines, right? So it actually only applies to about 5 or 10% of things that Canada exports, because the rest is either exempt because it's oil and gas, or exempt because it's part of the USMCA, as long as it's compliant with USMCA. So, but the USMCA agreement comes up for renewal in the next year. So it is going to be, very interesting. But the question, getting back to the question, is, you know, Trump's had some headline successes, apparently. I don't know if they're actual real successes or whether it's just, he just loves the headlines. But, and Canada doesn't have a headline like some of the other people have been able to get. Canada's headlines with Trump have been negative. So is there an approach that Canada could use that would cause us to get a great headline? This thing with Russia is interesting, because I remember when Trump was running, he said he would end the Ukraine-Russia war on the first day. He wasn't able to do that. Now, whether Putin led him to believe that he would end the war if he got elected or what happened, I don't know. But anyway, there is talk today on Friday as we are talking now, that Putin is willing to agree to end the war if he gets what he wants. But that's always been the case. He wants land. He wants a huge amount of territory in the eastern Ukraine. He took Crimea a few years ago, and now he wants some other parts of the of Ukraine. And Ukraine has said, up until today, consistently has said, we're not giving up any land, any more land, because they feel like Crimea was part of theirs as well. So whether this is the end or not of the war, I don't know. But I think Trump's desperate for distraction from his issue with the Epstein files. And so any announcement he can get, and maybe he's talked Putin into giving him another win in that regard. So, but whether it would be a real end of the war, I don't know. It might just be a headline.
Trump's 35% tariff is included on used vehicles being sold from Canada into the U.S. If the vehicle was built in the U.S., it's exempt from the tax. It means vehicles built in Canada and Mexico would be subject to the tax, along with vehicles from overseas. Could the tax put stress on car dealers who are used to moving a percentage of their used product into the U.S.?
Yeah, so I'm not sure about this question, because my understanding is it's very difficult to move used cars into the U.S. I did some research, and they have to be as particular. They have to be, for one, they have to be quite old, they have to qualify. Now, if they qualify under USMCA exemption, that would help them get approved. But if they don't qualify under that exemption, they're going to get hit. So there's a 25% tariff on car imports from Canada, and now this is another 30%. So it's possible those two could stack, right? So it could be looking at 60%. So that means that there's no way any used cars are going to go into the U.S. with a 65 or a 25 or a 35. There's probably very little moving. So that means that the used cars will be difficult to move. I did hear rumors of, I haven't heard about Canada, but I've heard about rumors about Mexico selling cars into the U.S. with 5 or 10 kilometers on them, calling them a used car. but I don't know what the tariff is on used cars from coming in from Mexico. So I do know that under Biden, they brought in 100% tariff on imports from China into the U.S., Chinese cars. And shortly after that, Canada put the same 100% tariff on. And that was because we were forced to. We had to match what the U.S. did as part of the pressure that U.S. put on the Canadian auto manufacturing industry. So what are we going to do now? I don't know. The Chinese exports of cars are exploding to everywhere in the world except for North America. They're obviously not coming into North America at all. They're going into Mexico big time. They're going into Europe. They're going even into Germany. It's unbelievable. But Chinese cars going into Germany, it's unbelievable. But it's happening. Brazil, all of the India, all of the places in the world. So, I don't think the used cars going from Canada to the U.S. are ever going to be a big deal. I think the bigger deal is going to be really good cars coming out of China that are really inexpensive. It's going to be very difficult for the car industry to cope with that.
With that rule, does it mean the used vehicle buyers in Canada will have a better selection and possibly lower prices due to increased inventory?
Absolutely. I mean, if those cars get stuck in the U.S., if they can't move them down to the U.S., there's going to be a surplus. And that'd be good for Canadian consumers and bad for Canadian automobilers, because the dealership, when they sell you a new car, they often take a trade-in, right? And then they have to get rid of that used car. They can't sit around with it. They can't sell it themselves, and they send it to auction. And if there's a surplus, they're not going to get very good prices at the auction. So it's going to be hard. The car dealerships are, I don't feel sorry for them. They've made so much money over the last 40 years. Unbelievable money. But it's getting tougher for them because, people aren't sure whether they should buy another gasoline car. Maybe they should buy an electric car. And most of the car dealerships don't have any electric cars to offer other than Tesla. So, it's a very difficult time for them. And the major automobile manufacturers, keep announcing, new electric cars. But when you look at the fine print, you find out, well, it's 2027 or 2028, or it's not a vehicle you can buy today. Doesn't do the dealership any good. I shouldn't say that. It does get somebody into the showroom, but then they have to tell them, "Oh, no, we don't have that vehicle until 2027, but we got this beautiful car over here you can buy right now." I'm sure that's going on a lot.
GM says the 2026 Chevrolet Silverado EV work truck did 1,060 miles in one charge, and the Lucid Air Grand Touring did 749 miles on a single charge. Both of those distances more than it is from where I live in Vancouver to where you are in Edmonton. Do you think these kind of distances are a game changer for the EV industry?
Well, one of the big blocks for people buying EVs is the range. So they get, when you talk to people, as I've been driving an EV for 9 years now, coming up to 10 years, and they sort of can understand everything. But then when they get to the range thing, range anxiety kicks in and say, well, yeah, but what if I want to drive all the way to Vancouver without stopping from Calgary? Well, first of all, why would you do that? Anyway, it's real. In their minds, it's real. So if people start hearing that they can go that far in a car. Now, I looked up that GMC Silverado because that was a shocking headline that came out. And it turns out that that's not a real situation. They've got a huge battery. So my Tesla has a 100 kilowatt hour battery, and they put a 250 kilowatt hour battery in a Silverado. They did some changes on the aerodynamics because trucks are particularly bad aerodynamics. And they did a bunch of other things. So it was a special vehicle, special circumstances in it. But it was a good headline grabber, clickbait. But it's not available to buy. It's not a real situation. The Lucid one, I don't know. Lucid does have a longer range, but where the EV experience is moving more towards is and this makes a lot more sense to me, is stopping every couple hours for about 10, 12, 20 minutes, kind of in that range, and maybe, you know, maybe go 3 hours without stopping, but you don't want to go, you know, we're talking in those numbers, we're talking going 7 to 8 hours without stopping. It's crazy, right? So nobody can do that. So they need a bathroom break at least. And so, so that if the charging time is an hour, that's not very acceptable for people. But some of the new cars, and again, I have to mention China again. They've got BYD's got a new car, and a couple other ones have a new car, and they can take on a significant amount of range in something like 10 minutes, like 200, 250, 300K in 10 minutes. So that's really, really convenient. You know, you go in, have a bathroom break, maybe buy something, you know, a snack or something, and you're back on the road in 11, 12 minutes. That's perfectly fine for most people, I think. And most people aren't doing trips all the time anyway. So around town, my car has a 620 kilometer range, and it's almost never a problem. When I go to Vancouver, like I did in July, I stopped twice, and that was fine. You know, I just stopped. Got to stop to eat lunch, got to stop to eat dinner. There you are.
As more and more people switch from ICE vehicles to EVs, could the cost of electrical power rise faster than it is right now?
So, in theory, it could, although the number of in North America, which is the biggest consumer of energy by far per capita, there's not enough EVs. So it's about 8% of the EVs that are being bought compared to ICE. So 92% ICE, only 8% EVs. So that's not going to show up anywhere in the numbers for electricity. The other thing to remember about charging a car is most people charge at home, and it's the same circuit as you have for a clothes dryer. So I don't think people charging their cars at home with a fairly light load type of circuit is going to make that much difference to the electrical grid. The other thing about electric cars, which is quite interesting, is they can be used as a storage. You know, people can be incentivized to, there's more and more solar being installed all over the world. And in the middle of the day, there's going to always be an excess of solar pretty well everywhere. And so people can charge their cars for free at the middle of the day. And when they turn on the switch, which they haven't done yet, but when they do, maybe 5 years from now or 10 years from now, whatever it is, the car will be allowed to provide power back to the grid or back to the household in the evening after the solar power is no longer available. So, I guess the short answer is yes, it's possible, but in practice, it's more likely that the widespread adoption of EVs would actually make the grid more resilient and more flexible. And one little known fact is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, draw of electricity in the world is refineries that refine crude oil into gasoline. Because a great big refinery has all these little motors that move the product through the pipelines, and they use a tremendous amount of electricity. So that's why when you see in the Gulf of Mexico a hurricane coming, all the refineries guys go to shut down their refinery because they don't want to have those electric motors shut down if the electricity gets knocked out, and have all their product in those pipes congeal or whatever it is they do. So, as demand for electric vehicles charging goes up, people are using less petroleum, then the demand for electricity to refine petroleum goes down. So it's not going to be as... The bigger issue is data centers. Data centers are huge. They use way more energy than electric cars. And I don't know the full story on that, but there's an awful lot of data centers being built right now, and they need a lot of electricity.
Any thoughts on what your next EV will be? You're currently a Tesla owner.
Yeah, so I've had my Tesla since 2021. I really like it, but it is it'll be 4 years old in a couple of months, and I'm thinking about it, and the best new cars that are coming out in the EV universe are coming from China. There's a new one called I'm going to get the name wrong, so I won't say it, but there's a couple of new offerings coming out of China. They're just spectacular. They're like my car's the top of the line Tesla, the Model S. This new car is from China. It's got everything that the Model S has, and it's they're sort of talking about a price before the tariff of like half of what you'd have to pay for a Model S. So they're selling it into Europe, they're selling it to Brazil, they're selling it into Mexico, but they can't sell it into Canada because of the tariff. But we'll see. The other possibility would be if Tesla, because it's been quite a long time since Tesla's done anything really innovative with the Model S, the original sedan. And so I upgraded twice before because the original early cars weren't that great. But now the one I have now is really more than adequate. So they would have to come up with an even better one to get me to switch to the new one. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, I there's also Lucid. There's some other ones. Lucid is very expensive, very luxurious EV. But I think all of the manufacturers 5 years from now will have offerings. And it's just they've been a little slow in getting out some really good ones. Tesla's a tough competitor, but I think more likely the Tesla killer will come out of China than out of GM or Ford or something like that.
Where can people follow you and where can they buy your book?
So I post on X, formerly known as Twitter, under HMACBE. And I also do a weekend note, which I think most people seem to find interesting. Comes out at the end of a week on Friday morning. And I post that on X and it's available, or you can sign up through email. And and then of course you can get the book at all the best bookstores and online with the ebook offerings.
Hilliard, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim. Great to talk to you again.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Eric Haddock, and Hilliard Macbeth. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.